This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 296 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. The 2019 FabFitFun Summer Box is on sale now. Treat yourself with items in it, such as the Wish Exfoliating Foot Mask, which is the perfect treatment for soft, smooth summer feet. So the timing of this is incredible.
Now, do you love discovering new products? I think we do. Are you a beauty and fashion maven constantly on the hunt for the next best thing? Ever read about or spot something online that you've always wanted to try but never have? You must try FabFitFun.
FabFitFun allows women everywhere to discover new products as well as including rave review must-have brands that you know and love. It's like Christmas four times a year.
So Summer, you said you liked the foot mask?
Oh yeah. I don't understand how it works, but it works.
I could see it being used before a pedicure to like prep so you don't embarrass yourself, or after a pedicure throughout the summer to help you like maintain, because that's I just love it. And something else that we like was that Grace and Stella Rose facial spray. It helps keep your skin fresh and moisturized, and you can actually use it under or over your makeup.
It's like liquid lotion.
Are you stumped on gift ideas? Well, FabFitFun is a great gift to give yourself or to a loved one. Surprise your mom or sister with a summer box as a gift or to show thanks. Do you have a daughter who's going to college or a friend maybe who's a new mom? FabFitFun is an awesome care package.
FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box delivered four times a year with full-size beauty, fashion, home, fitness, and wellness products for just $49.99 a box.
So honestly, even though there are some really, really, really great things in this summer box, like amazing things, it may sound silly, but I am so excited to try these Invisibobble. I've seen them everywhere. I've just never tried them. And they're really cool and they don't hurt your hair. Sign up for FabFitFun today. These boxes always sell out. Use our code OUTLANDER to get $10 off your first box.
Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use promo code OUTLANDER to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99.
Go to FabFitFun.com and use our code OUTLANDER to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along with Chapter 22, entitled, appropriately enough, The Fiery Cross.
So when I first started reading, I thought, oh, they're gone. I thought Claire was going to go with them. The men have all gone off to meet the regulators. No, they haven't yet. But Jamie had gotten up quite early and had gotten out and about to start the process of collecting the men. And he hadn't wakened Claire that morning. But the noise of the children outside had. And Mrs. Bug is bugged that Jamie hadn't waked her to, quote, provide a proper breakfast, unquote.
Good Lord. I was honestly more concerned with the fact that of the poor planning on Jamie and Claire's part with acquiring new, quote unquote, tenants.
Oh, Lord.
Right before the winter. So honestly, they had no control over when the regulator thing was going to go down. So they couldn't have anything to do with that. But bringing a bunch of new people to their property right before it's about to start snowing and get cold and not be building season seems really short-sighted. I mean, it seems like the best time of year to look for new tenants would be like maybe spring, like early spring. But like starting this whole process and bringing all these people so that everyone has all these people in their houses with them seemed really short-sighted to me.
Yeah, the timing is not ideal.
No.
The house is slowly waking up and Mrs. Bug does what she's best at, and that is managing households and feeding the masses. She is completely in her element. Megan P. writes, Fraser's Ridge and Mrs. Bug are giving me flashbacks to Castle Leek and Mrs. Fitzgibbons. It is crazy to think how many years and so many happenings since then. We learned that Adso of Milk, quote, had taken up semi-permanent residence in a cupboard in the surgery.
He knows where his mama works.
His mama. And I love the comparison of Claire's kitchen to a painting by Hieronymus Bosch.
Did you look one up?
Oh, I know very well. It's crazy town people in all forms of dress, undress.
I feel like I need positions. To look it up because I've heard the name before, but like it did not immediately bring anything to my brain. So hold, please. How do you spell his last name? Because I can't spell the first one. Bosch. B-O-S-C-H. Paintings. Oh, sweet Jesus.
Yep.
That's intense. That's a lot. I get it. Okay.
Megan P. writes, I've got to give it to Claire. She handles herself well in the midst of all the chaos in her home. I myself wouldn't be as gracious with so much estrogen and moving bodies in my house for so long. Oy. So Bree shows up, surprising Claire. She's like, what are you doing here? You've got your own house, girl. Well, guess who had shown up at Bree's house? The Mulots. All eight of them, saying Jamie had called for them. And then Jamie had come for Roger. And after that, quote, when Roger left, a big old Mueller got up off the floor and said, bitte, Mädle, and lay down next to me, unquote.
No thanks.
She thought she'd come to the big house. That dude, the big old Mueller, was Gerhard in his late 70s. According to Claire, quote, by no means harmless. Now, remember Nyawene? Yeah, that's Mueller. Not Mueller, that's Müller. Interesting that in the TV series, they did away with his wife and daughter. But was his son killed too? I don't know that they did. They only showed the house.
In the aftermath, we really only saw him.
His wife.
Yes, but then everything was lit on fire. And the assumption is that they were all inside, right? The Cherokee had retribution, correct? In the series.
That was the point, but...
She for sure is gone.
The daughter is the first one who died. The baby died probably soon. The baby died. Oh, yeah, I think the mom and the baby died from the measles. The mother, I don't know that she died in the book. I don't know. I don't remember.
No, but she had flaming arrows in her back.
Well, that's what I'm saying. In the TV series, she's really dead. So I don't. But we don't know if Petronilla's husband survived or Mula's sons. So there still could be Mula. Maybe not eight of them.
There could. We'll see.
And I wonder if we, because we still have Herr Müller, I wonder if he will be slipping into Bree's bed.
I hope not, because that's creepy. I understand that it's a sign of the times and it's, you know, any port in a storm kind of a thing. But at the same time, it's like, dude, be a little bit more respectful.
It's just a little bit of bundling. Come on.
No, it is not.
Never hurt nobody.
I don't think that's true. You can't prove it either way.
Megan P. writes, bless the adaptation for killing off the Mulots. I'd be team Marsley on staying friends with that lunatic Herr Müller.
Right?
So there's a conversation that happens in just a little bit, which we'll get to. But regarding killing off the Mulots, that's what we were just talking about. We're not really sure they did. Even though the way the mom died and maybe others, well, I can't say for sure if the mom died in the book because I did not go back and look, but they didn't address her in this chapter. We just know there are eight of them left. In the book, I think it was Petronilla and the baby at the minimum, but it wasn't like a whole bunch and there was no burning down the house. Burning down the house. In this TV series, the house is gone. The baby and Petronilla are gone and definitely the wife is gone. But we don't know if there's any more. So I don't think they've killed off the Mulots because Herr Müller still exists. But yeah, we'll have to see what happens with that. So the plan was for Mrs. Bug to finish and clean up after breakfast and then cook loads of potatoes because, you know, the Germans like the potatoes. I loved the scene of Claire taking stock of their food storage. It was really interesting that like how much they actually had, first of all, and some of the stuff she said that probably would not have caught my eye before, but has. I recently became a certified master food preserver in our local district, county, whatever. And in that process, I learned about food safety, food
preservation.
Well, yes. But the first thing we did was we learned the difference between food safety or issues that constitute food safety issues and then food spoilage. There's a difference between spoilage and safety. So just because like you and I may not eat slimy lettuce, but just because lettuce has got, I know, I agree. Just because lettuce has gone slimy does not mean it's dangerous. It is a food spoilage issue. It is not a food safety issue.
It's not dangerous. It's just nasty.
Totally.
Which I find personally dangerous. But here's what I want to know. In your little food preservation class, did you make head cheese?
Oh, nasty. Of course not. But let me get back to what I was saying. So first I'll read what I have in my script. So I just became a certified master food preserver, and Claire's description of the head cheese and how they might not die of tomaine poisoning was awesome. Just because she was just talking about, well, I smelled it, didn't quite smell off. It smelled of these herbs and garlic or whatever she put in it. And, you know, I don't think we'll die of this tomaine poisoning. And of course, I had to look it up. I have seen this word before. Now, I have heard, not in normal parlance, like every day around the water cooler chat, but I have heard or seen this word before, and I have looked it up before, and I'm pretty sure we talked about it in a podcast episode. So I know once in a while Diana's words come back, like susurrus, that comes back.
I've never heard that word.
Susurrus? Oh my God, it's in like every second book. I forget how to spell it, but it's there. So I had to look up tomaine poisoning because it had been a hot minute since I had seen it last. So what it means is food poisoning caused by bacteria or bacterial products. So specifically some kind of bacterial pathogen. So the interesting thing to me was something else that was preserved that I was like, wait, what? They did that? So yeah, I thought about the head cheese. I thought about looked that word up. And then as Summer said, she thought she might ask Gerhard Müller to try the head cheese first to make sure they didn't get sick, right? As a protective mechanism, like the royal taster. Flashback to a conversation about Gerhard and Jamie's hospitality toward him. And this is where Marsley is involved. So it was Claire, Jamie, Marsley, and Fergus. They talk about how Müller had taken vengeance for his daughter's death, for his family's deaths. And she asked Jamie, or they talked about, you know, would Jamie do something like that? And Jamie's like, that was his family. You know, you're asking me if I would do it. He did it. I mean, not something that we, you know, necessarily agree with, but it was, you're asking me something that he actually did. So, you know, kind of understand it from that perspective. And Fergus pipes in with, Frenchmen don't take vengeance. Claire thinks about that and's like, oh, and she thinks about a certain cult. She's like, I don't know about that. But back to the head cheese and the storage. She was worried about mice around the corn crib, and unfortunately, we add so was not growing fast enough quite yet. And here we have to share. This is Oso Christine O. She looked up head cheese and is going to tell us all about it. But before she did, she says, if you ever happen to speak to Lene, tell her I miss hearing from her once in a while.
Aww.
I don't think Lene's been on for Fiery Cross.
She has not. She definitely hasn't been on for Fiery Cross. I feel like she was on for an episode discussion last season, but let's find a horsey chapter and bring her back.
A horsey chapter, poor Lene. She's like, I'm not just a horsey. So Christine O continues. With all this focus on head cheese, I had to look it up so that since I remembered my mother used to say she loved it. I found a German recipe at burntmyfingers.com, and it does indeed involve a pig's head. The good news is that it's the head minus the tongue, cheek, eyes, brain, and anything.
All right. So, in the past, it absolutely did because of the gelatin that they get from the bones. However, you can make it today without the head, and it's still technically head cheese.
Yes, I'm getting to that, I believe. Okay. So she says, the good news is that it's the head minus the tongue, cheek, eyes, brain, and any visible yellow lymph nodes. Now that
part, I just want the bones.
That grosses me out more than the brain or anything. Lymph nodes? Bleh. I can honestly say this is good news because more than once as children, we were surprised with tongue and brains for dinner prepared by my mother, who grew up in the Deep South. The recipe says that, okay, so maybe it doesn't say that. The recipe says that after boiling the head for several hours, the meat falls off. And, quote, the best part is the cartilaginous snout and jowl meat and the endearing feathery ear. The rest of the recipe involves mostly spices and herbs and will probably show up in a future Outlander cookbook. This is probably difficult for a vegetarian to read. Sorry, Ginger. You're not sorry. Okay, but it's okay. So I can read it.
I just looked up a recipe on All Recipes. It's allrecipes.com. And this says hogshead cheese. And this calls for no head. It calls for 3 pounds of pork shoulder trimmed and cubed. But it also calls for 3 envelopes of unflavored gelatin, which is the thing that they're not getting because there's no bones in it. So when you boil the bones for a long, long time, I don't know. Have you ever made a bone broth, Ginger? Probably not. When you make...
Who are you talking to?
Do you forget that I just answered that question for myself? Okay.
Like, do you mean two seconds ago?
Uh-huh. Clearly. So if I am making like a broth. So if I make a broth and I just have like meat trimmings and like fats and things like that in there, it, when it's cool, it remains completely liquid. However, if I make a bone broth, which I throw like the entire like carcass of either the turkey or the chicken or whatever it is that I was cooking, and I throw that in there with all of the vegetables and the spices and things, what I'm left with later, while it is completely liquid when it is warm, when I put it in the fridge and bring it out later, it is now gelatinous. So the gelatin, obviously, is coming from the bones and the bone marrow. So when you take that away, you have to put it back in, which is the unflavored gelatin. So you are cutting corners by using the head if you have one, just lying around. Otherwise, like I said, you can do it with your unflavored gelatin. I am not remotely enticed to do this. I don't want to do it. We won't remember it viscerally from like our experiences in life, but there was a period in time when aspic was a very big thing.
Not in our lifetimes.
Not in ours. We may have been like infants.
The tail end. Yeah. Like in the 60s and 70s, I think.
Yeah. But what that is like unsweetened gelatin molds that had all kinds of nonsense in them. And this kind of... I'm not saying, because this obviously predates that, but I think it's definitely related to it.
Well, it predates the 1950s and 60s and 70s, but it actually, aspic was, it's a very big thing, or was a big, was a very big thing in the rich house, rich, royal, whatever.
Yeah, because it was, you homes had to be able to refrigerate, and being able to refrigerate something meant you were wealthy.
Well, maybe that too. I just mean, I have read so many descriptions of 18th, probably 19th too, but 18th, 19th century, like big lavish dinners where one of the courses is like fish, quote unquote, mock swimming in aspic, right? Because they're suspended. So it's supposed to look like they're swimming. Of course, they're dead. But yeah. So aspic is nothing new. But yeah, it definitely, as far as food preservation, and the head cheese and the gelatin, like that I can get. But as far as aspic for putting in a dish, I don't remember reading, or I don't remember a lot about aspic. Like that's like a recipe, right? That's not necessarily, that's a dish. That's not something to preserve. Although you're right. I believe aspic, gelatin, as you said, in that head cheese recipe was used to help preserve, especially back in the day. Claire continues to go through their larder, and she mentioned, this is what interested me actually, she mentions jams and preserves. Now, I wondered how they sealed them in an airtight container and how they prevented the growth of botulism. So seriously, I was very curious, because as our cohort learned about food safety, food spoilage, and all of that, there are a number of things you can do. You want to control the environment. so that pathogens cannot survive. And there are many pathogens, but the ones you really, potentially the most dangerous one that is not uncommon in ill-prepared preserved foods is botulism, because that one can kill. A lot of others could make you sick and might lead to death, but that one can absolutely kill and has in the past, you know, few years even. So a number of ways you protect against it is you want to make the environment, so the food product, as inhospitable to pathogens, including botulism, as possible. So that includes a low pH. That's a pH of lower than 3.6, 3.7. That might be a little bit too low, but it might be 4, but I believe it's under 4. It's like 3.7 or something. So a low pH, which means high acid environment, high acid, low pH. And you want to make it as dry as possible. You want to remove as much moisture because pathogens need moisture to survive and multiply. You want to, there's like 4 things. Oh, remove the air, because air in a closed environment, even a little bit of oxygen, again, helps them multiply. And I think there's another one, but those are the 3 that off the top of my head that I remember.
Remember that time when you were a master food preserver?
Shut the fuck up. Stop it. This is like the first lesson. Stop being a...
Have you met me? Oh my god!
No, that's true. That's true. You're the one who forgot Jamie's. So I'll let that go.
I didn't forget it. I blocked it out.
I don't believe it. Okay. So anyway, I was thinking like, oh well, what do they do back in the day? Because nowadays we can add certain things to lower the acidity. Depending on the product, you can add vinegar. You can add citric acid or lemon. You know, bottled lemon juice. You can add sugar, which obviously they could do, which sugar binds the water in the product, and that helps remove the water, even though the water is still in the jar or the holder. It removes the water from the product, or binds it, I should say. It binds the water, making it unavailable for the pathogens. And then
salt,
air. You obviously want to get the air, as much air as possible, out of the container. And you want an airtight seal. And so I was thinking about all the stuff that we were taught to do. And like none of that, well, sugar was available back then. But I'm like, I wonder how they did this. So I looked it up and I found, I know there are definitely more sources, but the one that I found, like, oh, this is pretty apt, actually. It's an 18th century food storage preservation techniques that I found a link from Colonial Williamsburg. I will share that link in the show notes. And it's very, 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 very interesting. She continues, Claire does, through the litany of their food storage and thinking of Jamie, wishes again she knew a little bit more or a lot more about possible battles to come. So Bree's out by the well thinking of how to make pipes to carry water to the house. Metal is out because of the availability and or the lack of availability and its expense. She says she can make a pump, like she can fashion a pump to carry water to the house. Ultimately, she's capable of that, but she's like, I don't know how we're going to do, because she's thinking of her own time when metal was used. So she's like, I don't know how we're going to do this, but I mean, I could do it. It's an option.
But she's so funny because she's just sitting there with her little sketch pad and she just goes, pipe. She just screams out, pipe. And at first I was like, wait, like, you want to smoke a pipe? And then she continued and I was like, oh no, she does not want to smoke a pipe. She would like to use pipes.
Turning to look for Jemmy, Brianna sees a cross. Quote, a rather big cross made of dried pine boughs, stripped of their twigs and bound together with rope. It was planted firmly at the edge of the dooryard near the big blue spruce that guarded the house. It stood some 7 feet in height, the branches slender but solid. It was not bulky or obtrusive, and yet its quiet presence seemed to dominate the dooryard, much as a tabernacle dominates a church. At the same time, the effect of the thing seemed neither reverent nor protective. In fact, it was bloody sinister.
But here's what I want to know. Because they both made mention to the fact that it was clearly something that Jamie would have done based upon how it was made. Does that mean it was really poorly crafted, or it was awesomely in detail
about how well it was made, and that's how they could tell that Jimmy did it.
Well, I don't know that they said well. They just said I could tell because he notched this thing out and it was straight and it was this. But it, at no time did they say I could tell from the master craftsmanship that this was Jamie's doing. It was just like we could tell Jamie had something to do with it. But they were not other than like you said that he picked straight branches and he notched them out. It was not real specific as to whether or not it meant that he did a good job. At least to me, that's how I read it. Or listened to it, whatever.
I walked slowly around it, looking up and down. Jamie had made it. I could tell by the quality of the workmanship. The branches had been chosen for straightness. That's true. So he didn't make them straight. He chose them well. And symmetry. Carefully trimmed, the ends tapered. The cross piece had been neatly notched to fit the upright rope binding a crisscross with a sailor's neatness. So there's at least two or three things that go to his craftsmanship. Mrs. Bug, right about now, comes out to report the wee rascal children had gotten into all the things. Claire freaks out about the idea of them being in her surgery and takes off. Two of the kids had gotten into her nice blue bottles, quote, and them a leaving bits of good food to rot and go bad, unquote. She's starting to connect these dots. Mrs. Bug had seen her moldy bread and had cleaned it all up. Because, you know, that's what a mensch does. Claire is about to get after Mrs. Bug when Mrs. Chisholm bursts in, pissed off at Mrs. Bug for laying hands on her kids. At first, Claire is trying to physically prevent Mrs. Chisholm from getting at Mrs. Bug, but then the latter goes into full-on shaming mode. Quote, how dare you? You and your family traipsing around in rags and tatters without a pot to piss in. Whoa. That stops Claire. The tuffle continues, and Mrs. Bug continues with her name-calling. Beggars, tinkers, gypsies. Claire stares Mrs. Chisholm into silence, and Bree grabs Mrs. Bug, bodily, and carries her away.
I don't think they're going to be able to do this in the series.
Probably not. Unless Sophie's, Mrs. Bug is like Sophie, 4 feet tall. Yeah, Sophie's
or
not
smaller.
That big.
Sophie's not that big.
She's 5'7", I think. By the time Claire turns back, Mrs. Chisholm is gone. Now, Claire is so upset about all the stuff that just happened that she hits her counter over and over. What the F? She's like, what's wrong with me? She kind of comes to her senses. What's wrong with me? She assures herself that all will be well regarding the women, that nothing was that serious and no one had gotten into her bottles. Thankfully, everything was okay. The only thing Mrs. Bug wouldn't touch or hadn't touched was the pouch given to Claire by Naya Wynne. Christine O writes, I was curious about how long it takes to grow penicillin, and according to a PBS NewsHour story in September of 2013, it takes several weeks. Unfortunately, without modern equipment, it used to take 2,000 liters of mold culture fluid to obtain enough pure penicillin to treat a single case of sepsis in a person. Well, that's kind of not wonderful to hear, because that makes me think anything that Diana ever does with Claire with penicillin is now not possible.
You don't know. She might have a ton of bread that's just molding.
It's not bread. It's 2,000 liters of the culture from it.
Mrs. Bug might have gotten like really bake happy and had so much extra bread that they just let it all mold. I know that it's not just mold, but you can't get the rest of it without the mold. You have to start with the mold.
I know, but that's like several villages worth of mold scraped and then processed to get it through a culture. Oh my gosh. Here I learn, because I read too fast in the beginning, that Jamie is not gone yet, but he has begun or had begun to gather the militiamen. Claire goes about her tasks with a somewhat absent mind, and she's easily distracted, always checking the sky and then looking over at that new cross. Jemmy, poor little dude, is breaking a tooth, and it's a bad one. Mrs. Chisholm, the star of this chapter, tells Brianna that she should just take him away so they don't have to hear him screaming. Because he's screaming, he's in pain. Yeah, that worked. Brianna's like, no, it's not, no. And she's so tired because she hasn't slept much because of this. So it's really harsh on Brianna, especially at this moment. So Claire is beginning to look forward to this journey with 20 to 30 unshaven reeking men for a week or two.
Hot.
With all so the hot. Chaos going it. On. So she volunteers and takes Jemmy on a little walkabout. She's like, I'm going to get the baby out of the thing so Brianna can go up and rest. And also, I'm getting out of Dodge.
She says, Brianna, go lay in my bed. No one's going to bother you when you're in my bed. One. Two, I'm going to take the baby and I'm getting the F out of this room with all these judgy women. And we're going to go do our own thing. And 9 times out of 10, once you start walking your cranky baby into an environment they're not used to, they're kind of just like, what is happening? And they kind of shut up. Now, that's not all children. Obviously, some children want to cry all the time, no matter what you do. But a lot of times, if you shock the babies into submission, that sounds bad. But if you just change the situation enough that they don't understand what's happening, they stop crying. That's it.
So she ends up taking Jemmy to, or trying to take Jemmy to the whiskey malting shed up there. She's like, you know what? Number one, let's go on a walk. Let's get out of here. But also, whiskey wouldn't hurt you and it wouldn't hurt me. So they're off for a walk. And they get to the clearing. As she's walking, surrounded by signs of autumn, a raven cries overhead, waking Jemmy. Now she's listening for others because, quote, one raven was an omen for change. Two were good fortune. Three were ill, unquote. But the raven was her guide, her spirit animal, according to Nyawene. She wonders what animal would be Jemmy's guide. In the end, it was only one raven, so omen of change it was. And she wonders aloud if Jemmy will inherit the house, just about his future. Will he live there with his children, etc.? Now, Diana gives us a description of the process of the selecting of the site for the whiskey shed, etc. And also, we get a wee tour of the shed itself. And then she describes this practice. Quote, normally, a small keg of whiskey was kept at the malting floor, both for the sake of hospitality and caution. If someone should come upon the lass alone there, best she have something to give them, Jamie had said. It's known what we do there. Best no one should try to make Marsley tell them where the brew is, unquote.
I mean, it's smart.
It is. But also, there's things I want to say, but I can't say and I won't say. That's it. Now, this
I
want to
know what you want to not say or don't say.
Nope. This tell charitable me, whiskey me. Is what Claire wants to use on Jemmy's teething gums, but she can't find it. So she goes to the place where I call it a hidey hole. It's not really a hole, but she goes to a type of hidey hole, to a place where she thinks where she knows some other whiskey is kept or maybe kept. And she goes literally through the stones, through some stones. Now, Jamie had rolled a large boulder to the head of a spring to mark it and had consecrated it. Now, once she's through the stones and out on the other side, she can see this trail. Now, in the spring and in the summer when it was full of foliage, like you couldn't even see it from where she was standing. But now because it was autumn, almost winter, it was very bare. So it was a lot easier to see the stone from where she was and also the path. So she takes the trail down to the spring and she finds a naked Jamie. Now, as she watches him, he blesses himself with water from the spring / cleanses himself. He does this 3 times, pouring a bucket of water over himself. It is to help prepare himself and to focus his mind. After a long moment of silence, he intentionally cuts his fingers with his dirk and drops some blood into the pool and then lays the dirk down and prays. And she finds herself, I don't want to say involuntarily, but it starts almost without her. She doesn't think, oh, you know, he's praying. I think I should pray for him. She like almost automatically starts to pray for him and for him to be safe because she knows that all this, she doesn't know what's coming. She knows a war is coming, but she doesn't know what's coming in the next few weeks. But she's just, you know, he's doing this before leaving for a potential battle. And so she's praying for his safety. Now, this line caught me. Quote, then he crossed himself and rose. And time started again. without my having noticed it had stopped, unquote. So she should have had a sense of this, at least, though. Note that this scene, at least according to that line, was out of time, or time stopped, quote unquote. Not only does Diana state it literally, she sends us all the flags when Claire is going through the stones. So there's a mini time travel that just happened in this chapter. She walks down to Jamie, who takes Jemmy from her, and Jamie gives him some whiskey. And Jamie tells her that Fergus has the cast that was missing from the mash house, and he's going to keep it. Now, as he whiskeys Jemmy, she whiskeys his fingers to clean them, to make sure that he doesn't have any bacteria in his finger wounds.
And is this before or after the water is dripping off of his cock?
I didn't remember the cock bit. I remember that they shriveled up, but I didn't remember the water was.
Davina was real clear.
Probably after.
But that was before, but it was definitely after, because Davina described the water dripping off of his cock long before Claire ever talked.
Because she's viewing Jamie. All of this from a distance.
Mm-hmm.
And then shriveled balls. After he's done, does she approach him. He says to her, "It's all right, Sassenach." He seems to say that when something bad is about to happen and he doesn't want her to worry. He mentions Dougal calling the clan and using the fiery cross. But Claire had only ever seen Colm do it at the oath-taking at Leek. Jamie describes the one time he'd seen it, the fiery cross, used to call to war. It wasn't until he'd made his way to the stable that the master of the horse, old Alec, told him the meaning of the cross. Quote, "When a Helan chief will call his men to war, he has a cross made and sets it afire. It's put out at once, Ken, with blood or with water, but still it's called the fiery cross, and it will be carried through the glens and quarries, a sign to the men of the clan to fetch their weapons and come to the gathering place, prepared for battle." Now, that had been the first time Jamie had used his sword against another man. Now, another note, when they were truly out of time, the time of the consecration, not simply when she went through the stones, Jemmy was silent entirely. Now, once Diana has that line where she remarks that Claire noticed time to start again, that's when Jemmy began to fuss again. So that was also an interesting observation. The difference now, though, regarding the fiery cross, is that the men who come to this call will be coming of their own will rather than being, maybe not forced to, basically forced to or expected to. Right now it's a hope, but it's, they don't have that relationship that a Laird had with its tenants, with a familial relationship, the clan relationship, is simply not there.
I mean, it's not, but isn't it there? It's there because he's, at least to the people who have decided to live on his land, those people, the expectation is completely there, right?
I think it's a hope.
Okay. I just feel like if you have families of people with the right aged males in there, that they would all understand that they're required to show up for the fiery cross.
I don't think you can say required, because even at the gathering when Jamie was going around trying to contact or have, I think he had Roger go around and he went around to talk to people who were going to be at the ridge or near on the ridge or, you know, on his lands. I forget the woman's name, but the woman who had the man who had some condition where he couldn't move and he couldn't really speak clearly, but his sister understood what he said. And she had two sons who were of age or near of age. And I think it was Roger. Roger basically was asking her, you know, could your sons be part of this? And she gave her permission. So it wasn't anything that he could actually require. He could not enforce it. He can just strongly ask and hope and, you know, maybe offer payment when and if maybe one day if he got some. But it was not the same relationship by any means that it was as a clan and tenant.
But you also have to understand that not all of the people that were being brought onto his land to be quote unquote tenants were from the feudal, not is feudal right? The clan system. Not feudal is not right. So we're from the clan system where they all understood
that. But that actually makes the point further. Because they weren't from that, it was even less like that system. So it is even more of a, I hope you can help me, please, than even less of a requirement because that was not their own tradition, even back in Scotland. Claire, in thinking about how Boston-centric her and Bree's knowledge would be about the revolution, thinks, not by a long chalk. Now, I had to look that up. I'm like, wait, shot? So according to Grammarist.com, not by a long shot is an idiom that is primarily used in the U.S., while not by a long chalk is an idiom that is primarily used in Britain. An idiom is a word, group of words, or phrase that has a figurative meaning that is not easily deduced from its literal meaning. Though the definitions of not by a long shot and not by a long chalk are identical, the two terms have very different origins. Not by a long shot is a phrase that describes something that is highly unlikely, something that does not come anywhere close to succeeding. The term long shot is something that is highly unlikely and is sometimes used outside of the idiom, not by a long shot. Originating sometime in the late 1700s, the phrase refers to the likelihood of hitting a target that is very far away. Long shot came to be used in horse racing in the mid-1800s to mean a horse that had very little chance of winning. Today, not by a long shot is used in everyday language, primarily in North America. Whereas, not by a long chalk is a phrase that also describes something that is highly unlikely, something that does not come anywhere close to succeeding. The idiom, not by a long chalk, first appeared in the early 1800s, derived from the practice of using chalk to keep score in games of skill, particularly in English pubs. The practice is still widespread today in games such as darts. The idea is that the player is determined to persist even though there may be a large score or long chalk against him. Very interesting. So Claire tells Jamie about how Boston had been settled by this time in their history in the 18th century, had been settled for a while by then, and basically it comes to the same point that he had been trying to make. The population and settlement on the ridge and surrounding areas was nothing like long settled city of Boston. There weren't generations long friendships or familial bonds to link people and to make them want to fight to protect each other, nor the peer pressure of not being branded a coward for not fighting. So she asks him, why will you do it? And Jamie says, he will do it because he believes. He believes her. He had believed her about Culloden, and as bad as that was, some of his men, and much of his family had survived because of it. But this time, he had from her assured victory. With the knowledge that the crown would not prevail this time, he can defy the crown and willingly be branded a traitor for the sake of his family and his new country. In the short run, he must remain loyal and try as Tryon's man. In the long run, to remain a loyalist would also be no bueno. Christine O. writes, the dilemma that Jamie faces is so interesting. How to get men to follow him into a potential battle for Tryon and the king, whom he himself does not support, knowing that at some point Britain will lose power and the rebels will gain power. It's a sticky situation. They chat about old Simon, the old fox, and how he may have had such a virtue as family feeling in the end, when they talk about how he is the one who ended up on Tower Hill and not his own son. Claire does not like that feeling. She doesn't like to give the fox, old fox, any credit whatsoever. And this line straight up reminded me of what Jesus said in the garden, or in the Bible, what it says, according to tradition, that Jesus said in the garden at Gethsemane, And of course, when I say this, I'm probably gonna get part of it wrong, but I think of Jesus Christ Superstar when he sings like, "Take this cup away from me," and that's probably wrong. How does it go?
I mean, those are the words.
I know. Thanks a lot. I mean, what's the brand? I'm not asking for a performance, but do you know the tune even of just those words?
I mean, that was close, but
okay. So for Shiggles, we'll say that was not wonderful, but somewhat approximate. Of course,
I don't want to taste its poison.
Yes, dude, that musical. Oh, holy Dukas, that gets me every ding dong time. So even though, and I'm sure there are other verses that are actually verses, stories, lines, whatever from the Bible somewhere else that I am not even including here. Or other conversations that actually make more sense for the people or the types of people who are speaking or the genders who are speaking. But from the Bible, from that line attributed to Jesus, "Take this cup away from me," or at least from Jesus Christ Superstar, attributed to Jesus by Andrew Lloyd Webber. Except in the book, it's Claire basically doing the begging. Claire is like, do you have to do this? Quote, "I had a sudden passionate wish to urge him to throw it all up, turn away from it, tell Tryon to stuff his land, tell the tenants they must make their own way, abandon the ridge and flee. War need not engulf us, not this time. There were places one could go to," unquote. So she wants him to turn away. It's not Jaime who is turning away. And we know from Diana herself and all the books that Jaime is a Christ figure, if anyone is. So he definitely would represent Christ. And so that's why my comparison, my insight, quote unquote, does not truly align with that scene I'm remembering, or with those lines I'm remembering from the Bible, as far as "Take this cup away from me," or the musical. Because in the show, in the Bible, it's Jesus saying that, right? Here, Claire's not saying it, but Claire is wishing it with all her heart. So, but in the end, Jaime most definitely does not sway at all. He does not waver. Also, if that naked Jaime baptizing himself in the stream isn't a Christ figure, nothing is. And then he tells her, meaning Tryon and the militia, quote, "This is a very little thing, but it is the beginning, I think," unquote. And then shrewdly, quote, "If I will save these men, if they will walk with me between the fires, then they must follow me without question. Best it begins now, while not so much is at stake," unquote. So that's also very smart. Not only does he need the men right now because of what he's been ordered to do basically by Tryon, it's also better now to get this started, because when the shiz hits the fan and the actual revolution starts, and he's gonna be up to the time before he turns on the crown, or at the time he is a rebel, he is gonna need an army. He's gonna need, you know, he's gonna want support, or at the very least, he's gonna want people who support him who will watch his home while he's gone. He's also wearing a kilt, so we get a reminder of his Highlander-ness. So that kind of helps. At least some of the men. If the men aren't Highlanders, it only points out his differentness, his difference. But for those who are Highlanders, but who didn't grow up with him, you know, didn't know him, it can help. Also, hello, quote, "He was quiet, absorbed in what he was doing, dressing with a calm precision that was unnervingly reminiscent of the robing of a priest," unquote. So many references here. So many references here. And then, quote, "He took the knife away from Jemmy, wiped it on a fold of his plaid, and slid it away into its scabbard. He was finished," unquote. And the most chilling part of the chapter, to me at least, when asked if it were God he were calling upon at the water, Jemmy says, "Oh, no, I was calling Dougal MacKenzie." And so, with the ghost of Dougal MacKenzie in her thoughts, they leave for home.
I call the ghost of Dougal MacKenzie all the time.
Doing what?
I'm not going to tell you that. Something's
private. I knew it. Personal shiz. That's why she doesn't want to talk about Jamie's cock drippers. Dripping.
Cock drippers? Is that a thing?
I meant dripping.
Dripping water. That's not, you're making it not, still not cool or sexy.
Sorry.
Use your NPR voice, please. Use your NPR voice, please.
It's done. I only have a few more comments.
All right. But before, hey, pause. With me.
Oh, that's what you were doing the last 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, do it again. Central.
Hang on. He hasn't done it yet.
I only want to say, if there is a way, take this cup away from me, for I don't want to taste its poison, feel it burn me. I have changed. I'm not as sure as when we started.
Anyway, you were close.
Oh,
you were close.
Not wonderful, though. Saying. It wasn't wonderful.
And that was the original Jesus. Oh, Ted Neely.
That was from
2006.
Wait. Oh, sorry. I'm thinking of 70s. Sorry.
I know. This was... No, but I'm saying this is the original Jesus from Jesus Christ Superstar. But when they did the benefit concert in 2006.
He came back for it?
Yes.
Oh, shut up.
In New York, yeah.
And his voice is redonk still. Oh, my gosh.
For show.
Oh, fudge a monkey. So Megan P. writes... I'd have gone into hiding too after the mama drama. Claire has a lot of unknowns that are on her mind. If I were her, I'd want to just for once be settled with nothing unsavory on the horizon. Please. I for sure think all these women on the ridge are liable to shed some blood, and I don't mean their monthly cycles.
I would have kicked all of those bitches out of my house. That is the bottom line. I don't have time for any of that. They would have all been kicked out of my house. I'm like, y'all need to go like pitch a tent someplace else to do your little contest, because that's what this is. This is all who has the bigger boobs, who has the better vagina. I don't know.
Ovaries.
There's no to measure. There's no to measure.
You
my point
me
is
so
is
many
that,
bicycle horns. Girl, stop.
My point is that we nobody has
point.
Time for that.
I agree.
So go someplace else, figure it out, and get out of my house. I don't have time for this. I should have a respite. From this,
Megan P. continues, I love the end of the chapter. I'm with Claire. I would watch Jamie Fraser do anything and be completely captivated. And Christine,
I don't know. I don't want to watch him make head cheese.
Oh, summer. Christine O. finishes us off.
So she's going to finish us off. Get it, Christine. I'm ready. I'm ready. Lord. I've been so poised for the last hour. Finish me off.
Summer's for the last hour been doing the thing that she's not going to tell us about when she thinks about. Okay. I just finished reading Washington Life by Ron Chernow.
Oh, it's good.
Stop. I haven't read that or listened to that.
Do it. I promise you that one's even longer than Hamilton.
I meant to say or, but I said whore. Sorry. I haven't listened to that, Summer. This is a confession to Summer. You guys, I'll let you hear me. Or listen, I haven't listened to that one, but I also 2 years behind on that one.
Girl, you have no more excuses. You've had nothing but time.
I have nothing but time?
Nothing but time.
You're such
a
nut job.
So the Chernow, I know. I'm a bitch. I get it. My point is that Hamilton was exquisite. That biography by Chernow was exquisite. And I super enjoyed the Washington one as well. And it's way longer because there's so much more history that's readily available for George Washington. So it's beefier.
Christine continues. This book about Washington by Ron Chernow. Washington, who had served the British as commander-in-chief of all Virginia forces during the French and Indian War, began struggling with this exact problem at precisely this time. He started a boycott of English goods and was instrumental in getting the Townshend taxes repealed, except for the fateful one on tea. But at the same time, he was still ordering gold jewelry and pigskin saddles from England and attending parties honoring the king's birthday, or going to the theater and watching surgeries with Jamie and Claire. He lived in a world... Oh, actually, no, he left at that point. Anyway, He lived in a world of contradiction, criticizing Parliament yet socializing with the royal governor. And Jamie likens the situation to be like walking between fires. Most people in the country must have felt this way. And for them, it was worse because they had no idea of the outcome.
And that was chapter 22. Join us next week when we will be discussing chapters 23 through 25. And if you'd like to join the conversation, please go to www.outlanderpod.com/fierycross. Is that it? There you will find a link to the schedule and the available chapters that have room still to be assigned for contribution. So if you leave a message on the Facebook page, we will look at it and add you to the list.
And as always, we'd love you to join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Join us at outlanderpod.com/group. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.